following program is brought to you in living color on
DailyGazette.com or wherever you get your podcast.
The Daily Gazette Company presents the Parting Shots Podcast. Now, here's your host, Daily Gazette sports editor, Ken Schott.
Thank you, Scott Kesey, and welcome to the Parting Shots Podcast, available wherever you get your podcast. Subscribe today. Thanks for joining me from the Parting Shots Podcast Studio in Schenectady, New York. Final podcast for the month of May, and we have just a guest for us on this edition. It's Alan Crida. He's a veteran sports journalist down in New York City. He's covered many hockey games for the Associated Press. I met him a couple of years ago at the inaugural New York State Hockey Hall of Fame induction. And we've kept in contact ever since, and I'll see him again in July for the next edition of the Hall of Fame induction ceremony. And he collaborated with Ken Morrow, member of the USA Miracle on Ice gold medal winning hockey team in 1980 in Lake Placid, and then won four straight Stanley Cups with the New York Islanders. They collaborated on the book entitled Ken Morrow, Miracle Gold, Four Stanley Cups, and a Lifetime of Islanders Hockey. Ken was inducted into the New York State Hockey Hall of Fame last year, was unable to make it because of some travel issues, but he's I guess expected to be at this year's banquet in July. So we'll talk to Alan Crida about his stories and memories with Ken Morrow, stalwart defenseman for the Islanders and that USA hockey team. It wasn't a superstar, but he did his job well. And of course, you know, obviously with a gold medal and four Stanley Cups, he did okay for himself. He played college hockey at Bowling Green at that time, Minnesota, and the Boston area teams were the dominant teams in college hockey in the 1970s. And college hockey back then really wasn't thought of. It was just a niche sport, which, you know, tonight now it gets a lot more attention, a lot more teams involved. So we'll talk to Alan Crida about Ken Morrow. So that's coming up next year on the Parting Shots podcast. But before we go to break, we remember Rick Derringer, the rock and roll musician who passed away Monday at the age of 77. Was a member of the McCoys with the hit in the 1960s, Hang On Sloopy. And he did Real American for Hulk Hogan and the WWE back in the 1980s. As if you remember back then, music, rock and roll, music and wrestling started to intertwine back in the early 80s. Started with Cyndi Lauper and Captain Lou Albano. Gosh, I do know too much about this stuff. But of course, his biggest hit came in the 1970s with Rock and Roll Hoochie Coo, and let's take a snippet of that. And rest in peace, Rick Derringer.
Measure the value of education-based athletics? Well, the value is in what makes it invaluable. That's because school sports aren't just about winning. They're about learning and growing. School sports aren't just about gaining trophies and accolades. They're about learning life lessons, bringing a whole community together, developing character and integrity, having coaches who mentor you and teammates who become lifelong friends. And you can't put a price on any of that. That's what makes education-based athletics invaluable. Of course, when you participate in school sports, you want to win and become a better athlete, but the purpose is so much greater, becoming a better person. Support your local school sports programs, and if you have a student, encourage them to get involved.
This message presented by NISFA and the New York State Athletic Administrators Association.
Hi, I'm Stan.
And I'm Shen.
And each week we bring you the Stan and Shen Show. And each week we talk about fun things through our travels throughout the capital region. We touch on food, we touch on news, try to touch heavily on good news. And Shen's always available with hot takes.
Yeah, so if you could follow along and listen to us every week on dailygazette.com or on all major streaming platforms, we'd love to have you join us.
Hi, this is Union College Women's Hockey Head Coach Tony Macy. You're listening to the Parting Shots podcast with Daily Gazette sports editor Ken Schott.
Welcome back to the podcast. My next guest helped write a book about Ken Morrow, the four-time Stanley Cup champion with the New York Islanders. Of course, remember the Miracle on Ice team in 1980, won the gold in Lake Placid. And my friend met him a couple of years ago at the New York State Hockey Hall of Fame induction ceremony, and we've become pretty good friends. It's Alan Kreduk. Alan, welcome to the podcast. How are things going?
I'm great. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, I appreciate it. This book has been out for a while, and I've heard some great reviews of it. Let me ask you, if all the that New York Islanders team, there's a lot of great players on that team, like Billy Smith, who's getting inducted in July this year for the New York State Hockey Hall of Fame, Brian Trottier, Dennis Poffin, Clark Gillies. Why Ken Morrow as a subject?
Ken, to me, was unique. He has the magical double of gold medal, 1980, Miracle on Ice, Lake Placid, and follow that with four Stanley Cups in a row with the Islanders. Not only is he the only player to do that, to do a Stanley Cup gold medal double in the same year, but he won the fourth straight, which really, in looking now back in time, is becomes more incredible. And his story is just one of really amazing perseverance, dedication, hard work. To me, he's unique that he did what he did, and he's so humble about it. And we just were talking for a magazine piece I was working on about the dynasty, and I said, you know, your stories are so amazing, it should be a book. And he said, my kids have been telling me the same thing, so why don't we talk more about it? So one thing led to another. We just kept it going. I said, let's start with the subject. Let's pick a year, pick a cup, pick a moment. And we just started talking about the 1983 final and his heroics in game four against Edmonton. And one thing led to five more stories, at the 10 more stories, and here we are with the book a couple of years later.
Yeah. I mean, as I said, I mean, he wasn't what you call the stars, one of the stars of the team, but he was, maybe best describe him as a lunch pail guy who knew what his role was and did it to a great perfection.
Definitely. Just unassuming, focused, defensive defenseman to a T. No mistakes. Stay out of the goalie's way. Do your job. Don't screen. Just don't take penalties. Just do the physical hard work of playing defense, and opportunities will follow. But he was the true defensive defenseman for Herb Brooks's Olympic squad, and then with Al Arbor's Islanders teams to a T, to the point that when he arrived on Long Island after the Olympics, after the goal, just a few days later, the same week, a week after that, after he played his first game, the Islanders traded for Butch Goring from the Los Angeles Kings, were able to trade away longtime stalwart defenseman Dave Lewis. Billy Harris made the trade for the so-called catalyst that gave the Islanders that extra gear they didn't quite have in previous playoff runs, and Ken Mara's arrival led to Butch Goring's arrival. And those two factors, in addition to the addition of Gord Lane on defense earlier that season, are the three key moments that Ken spoke about that he thought, and other Islander players, teammates thought, were the big factors in helping them win that first cup in 1980.
Well, I hated that because I was a Flyers fan. So.
I understand.
Well, I told, you know, Bob Nystrom was inducted in the inaugural class, and then John Tilley was inducted the year later. I told both those players. And there's a misconception that Nystrom's goal was offside, and I fully maintain that that play was the only, my only complaint about that play is I don't think Pete Peters, the Flyers goaltender, gave enough effort to get his blocker out there to stop the backhander. But there was a goal in the first period that was offside, and they had ready review. But I mean, there's some people out there who still believe that goal was offside. I said no, that was not the goal that was offside. But yeah, you know, Kenny Martin, having to join a team, an Islanders team that probably was on the brink of maybe breaking up, because that team had been doing well, had some great regular seasons, but they fell short in the playoffs. I mean, they lost to the Maple Leafs in 78 in overtime in the quarterfinals at home. They lost to the Rangers the following year in the semifinals. And Ken Mara's coming into the situation with how much of an adjustment was it for him and for the team to accept him? You know, obviously, he's a rookie coming into a situation where maybe it could be a disaster.
Yes, it wasn't easy. I think he just rolled with the adrenaline. He said, "I'm just here to do my job." You know, he wasn't thinking about the Islanders throughout the Olympic run. He was doing his job there. He had been drafted back in 1976, so it was a long time that he knew he was heading for that team. He didn't know the circumstances. It was 4 years of college, then the U.S. team, then the Olympics, then the gold medal. Like, a lot had happened before he really took time to focus on, okay, now I'm an Islander. And Bill Torrey was in Lake Placid, saw the gold medal game, saw the Soviet game. In the book, we have a picture of the ticket stub that his son Rich held on to, signed by Ken Mara somehow from the Olympic weekend. Incredible to see that. And Bill Torrey just said, "Hey, you're coming with us now. You're going to join the Islanders straight out." And in his first game, he's paired with Denny Potvin, who's coming back from a 30-plus game injury, missing all those games through a thumb injury. So he was thrown right into it and had to adjust. He said, "I just played my game. I just did the same thing I learned on the fly. NHL was a different story. You know, I had to get right into the last 18 games and then the playoffs." So I think his quiet demeanor was a big help. Some of the guys joked, we didn't hear him even speak for the first month. He just came in and put the jersey on. He went from number 3 with the Olympic team to number 6 as an Islander and never looked back. Just went right on, right into the lineup. And Billy Smith, he said, loved him right away. He said, I'm not getting in his way. I'm not. Do the job. He's like, don't screen me. Just take guys out, way out there, pass the blue line if you have to. And so he had ease with the goaltenders. He did well with his partners. Everyone accepted him. Quiet guy. Just the Islanders were a team of lunch pail players, some superstars, but they all were lunch pails. They all went into the corners to do the job. And Brian Trottier to Wayne Merrick to Dwayne Sutter. All these forwards did the same job that the Islander defenseman did. So he had compliments. He had Stefan Pearson at times as another offensive defenseman to go with his defensive style. He played with Dave Langevin a lot through the Cup years and Denny at times. So he had stars on his other side of the blue line, and that made his transition a whole lot easier.
Yeah. Let's talk about his time with the Miracle on Ice team in 1980. This is a team basically comprised of players from Minnesota and the Boston area. Kenny was an outliner because he was from Bowling Green, which really, maybe at that time, it was starting to, you know, they ended up winning a national championship under Jerry York in 1984. But you know, you have the Boston and the Minnesota guys, and you have this kid from Bowling Green. I mean, what did Herb Brooks see in him that made him pick him for the team?
It's quite something. I mean, he had his eye right on this player from a different school, in a different place, almost a different conference. I mean, Herb saw him playing with Minnesota, though. So, you know, it was different. Yeah, he saw size. He saw strength. He saw steadiness. He liked him so much. He pretty much had him penciled in the whole way, apparently, and even let him keep his beard.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that.
Was a Herb Brooks no-no. But his rationale, well, he had the beard coming in, so I'm not going to ask him to shave it. Same thing happened later with Al Arbor. So Ken Mara managed to get through various major rules and his steady play. Again, Herb just liked players he can count on to do the job, work hard, and not talk. Maybe was part of it. I think, you know, he just wanted, and the size was also enough to attract the Islander scout Jimmy Devolano. Saw him playing the freshman in 1975. It was late 1975. He saw Ken play a game in Toronto. So same thing that Herb Brooks must have seen a few years later, this steady, quiet, sizable defenseman just playing his game, stood out at a young age, stood out as a team playing for his country, and again, perfect defensive defenseman in Herb Brooks's revolutionary system, but he not everyone could be a speedster or a playmaker. He needed that rock on defense, and if anyone proved to be that, it was Ken Morrow.
And that was at a time, too, when you regularly see college hockey players in the National Hockey League, but back then, even towards 1980, there weren't that many college hockey players in the National Hockey League. I think a lot of teams avoided college because they didn't think the college players were maybe tough enough. It was mainly junior hockey. So to have a college guy, join the Islanders like that.
Definitely. I mean, he not only opened the door for American wave of players, college became a scouting ground, probably to a larger degree with a lot of those guys. They had started in college, but the NHL was heavily Canadian. You weren't going to see American college kids breaking through, but 1980 helped that a long way. All the stars to follow in the 4+ decades since owe a great gratitude to that 1980 team. And Bowling Green, I mean, they came close to a national title, didn't quite get there, but they were in the Final Four with Ken. They had near winning. He almost did the trio within a couple of years, something Neil Broughton did later on, but over the course of a longer career. Mm-hmm. So incredible, really, what he was able to do in college for a very good team through his 4 years, most of those seasons, and then to be handpicked by Herb Brooks and make that team and be a key part to the winning. And then the Islanders, I mean, the coaching lineage of his life is also something we highlight in the book, just to have played for the coaches he played for, and just Al Arbor, the defensive defenseman that he was, mm-hmm. to inherit Ken Marr, and basically I'm sure he saw himself in that style of play that he brought. So it was a lot. It was a lot. Maybe the pressure didn't get to Ken. He just played his game again. Wasn't thinking about after this, I have to do that. I'm just out here doing my job. He suffered, he had some knee problems early in his Islander career. The injuries, the knee stuff stayed with him, but he played through a lot of that through the Cup years. He even hurt his shoulder in Lake Placid, didn't complain, kept right on going. Like these, just cut from a cloth of we're just playing, doing our job, we're not complaining. We have some injuries, we're going right through them, and I think that everything he brought to the rink rubbed off on his teammates day in and day out.
He joins the Islanders, obviously coming off the gold medal win. Do you think his ability to win a championship like that, was he able to maybe help guide his teammates through this and be able to handle the pressures that maybe previous Islander teams did not?
I think so. I think there was definitely a calmness that came with him that he brought that was real, and it cut through a lot of the pressure perhaps that the Islander players had been feeling for some years before he got there. So yes, I definitely think so.
Talk about you mentioned the Edmonton series, the first one in 1983, and the influence in that game 4. What was that like for him?
The final Cup, it was, he talked a lot about how he did not want to give Edmonton a chance to get a game back in Edmonton. Like when they were up 3-0 against the vaunted Oilers, he did not want any gasp of positivity going Edmonton's way, mm-hmm. even though they had that commanding lead. So that game was a frenzy of we have to win today. We can't let them have a chance to get back home. And him, Ken Marr scoring the empty net goal. He had 3 overtime goals in the Islander Cup run, a 5-year run, which is the most of any Islander, believe it or not.
Wow.
But yep. But that empty net goal he scored in the closing seconds of game 4 at Nassau Coliseum is one of his career favorites, because it was he's putting the punctuation mark on all of this, and he's a defensive defenseman who outscored Wayne Gretzky in that final series. I mean, how can you explain that Wayne Gretzky was held to 4 assists? Ken Morrow gets this overtime hero goal against the Oilers earlier in his career in 1981, and then he scores this empty net goal to cement the fourth Cup. So he definitely is a not a good thought for those Oilers dynasty teams to be, but Ken Morrow didn't he got in their way a lot, before they could win a cup.
And that playoff year in 83, he had a career high 12 points on 5 goals and 7 right. assists in 19 playoff games. And he basically nearly matched his regular season total of 16 points right. that year.
It's quite amazing when you look at the numbers. Even he's amazed when he looks and he's like, I can't really explain that. A little bit of right place, right time. Again, just doing my job. Sometimes one thing leads to another, and that's how I explain my success.
Of course, you mentioned the overtime goals, and one of his biggest ones came the following year in the Pactor Division semifinals against Rangers, Game 5 at the Coliseum. Scores from yes. the right point on a screen, beats Glenn Hanlon to end that series, and advance the Islanders on to face the Washington Capitals in the Pactor Division final. What did he remember about that goal, and how big was that for his career?
Same kind of unbelievable. I can't believe it happened, but I was in the right place at the right time, and the puck found me. And he jokes that basically every time he scored one of these big goals, it was his 48 or 49 mile an hour slap shot that got it done. You know, maybe he wants to put the puck on his stick in this moment, and it's a knuckleball. It's a shot that the goalie doesn't maybe see clearly, and it's in. And that's what he did. He did it against the LA Kings. He did it against Edmonton. He did it against the Rangers in that cup run. I mean, it's one of those unexplainable phenomenons.
Yeah, I mean, of course, the Islanders' cup run dynasty ends in that year. I mean, how tough was that for not only Ken, but for the team to not try to match Montreal, what they did from 1955 to 1960, five in a row?
It was a lot. I mean, they were exhausted. They were so exhausted at the end. They ran out of gas. They fell victim to the schedule change. They went 2-3-2 instead of 2-2-1-1-1. A lot of the Islander players to this day are so unhappy about that, as they felt that if they had gotten it back to the Coliseum for Game 5, it would have been a chance. But once Edmonton got on a roll at home, it was almost an unstoppable juggernaut, and the pure exhaustion of it all just caught up with them. They could not find the gear to win a game in Edmonton. And that Game 5, they were down 4-0. Palafontaine, the newcomer, scored twice early in the third. There was this glimmer of hope, but they just didn't have enough, and pure exhaustion. It was the one time Ken was on the losing side, the first time really in 5 years, since the 70s, since before the Olympics, that he was on a season-ending loss. So that was a new experience for him, and he said he finally knew what everyone else was feeling when the Islanders beat them through those 19 straight series wins. So it was an ordeal. He and his teammates both said it was the quietest plane ride ever, and the air was out of the balloon, and that was that. But they had accomplished something incredible, and I think looking at it years later, gives it a lot more heft than it did at the time, when it's sheer disappointment. So to win 4 cups in a row and almost the fifth, almost 20 straight series, incomprehensible numbers. But it had to end at some point. It just ended that way. If it had gotten, they had tied the Canadians for 5 and defended it in 1985, I think that would have been a different narrative. But changes started pretty quickly after they lost in 84. Which Goring was out by the next year. Clark Gillies and Bob Bourne were waived the following. Like changes happened quickly. John Tinelli traded, but what a run. And he was right in the middle of it as soon as he got there and the whole way through. So he's held in super high regard by his Islander dynasty teammates.
And, of course, he played in one of the most memorable games in National Hockey League history in 1987, the 87 playoffs, the Pactor Division semifinals of Game 7. In Washington against the Capitals, that went 4 overtimes on Easter Sunday. And I remember that night well because I had just driven back from Rochester covering Hershey Bears playoff game that they got eliminated by, and went to the office the next that night and did some stuff, and then the game was still going on. My VCR had run out of time because I had set for like about 3 hours, and I probably didn't set it up. But see Pat LaFontaine score the goal there. What did Kenny remember about that night?
Total exhaustion and how much water, how much weight he lost trying to stay hydrated. Just it went on and on and on and on. I mean, it was a different team. They had elements, of course, of the Cup guys, but it was a different dynamic, and they were pushing Washington, who couldn't ever seem to beat the Islanders year after year after year, but just this Twilight Zone feeling of playing on. And here he is in another epic overtime. I think he was probably somewhere along the lines, probably surprised or thought he'd get the goal since he'd gotten so many of them, but it was Pat Palafontaine's whirl around shot from the blue line, fourth overtime at 2 o'clock in the morning, I mean, Easter Sunday. Crazy. But Kenny, just exhaustion, a different kind of exhaustion from the game in Edmonton where they lost the cup, but to win a game seven that way, it was the last great moment of his playoff career. 88, they lost in New Jersey in the first round, and so that was it. That was the last moment of playoff glory for Ken Morrow.
Yeah,
1987, Easter epic.
Well, of course, he was part of some glory just recently as the Islanders, who really had a very minimal shot of getting the number one draft pick in this June's NHL draft, pulled it off. Another miracle in ice for Kenny Morrow. I mean, he had to be thrilled being a part of that.
Oh, completely. I absolutely overwhelmed by the moment. Couldn't believe it. Shocked, stunned, amazed, all those emotions, and it just the right place, right time. There he was. The Islanders hadn't hired their GM as yet, which they've done in recent days, Matthew Darche, and Kenny was asked to represent them, and luck finds him yet again. Some random numbers, and he's there front and center in the Zoom box, and Islander jersey, lucky, and he had a blue Islander hat on, and couldn't believe it. 3.5% chance turned into 100% chance.
Yeah.
Another miracle courtesy of Ken Morrow.
Well, at least it's the NHL draft was up on the up and up. We're not sure about the NBA draft at this point, but
right.
I digress. Right. But yeah, we should mention that Kenny was, I think, if I didn't mention at the top of the broadcast, we mentioned that Kenny was inducted into the New York State Hockey Hall of Fame last year, was unable to make it, but I believe he's going to, there were some travel issues and plane got canceled, but I think he's planning to come in this year for this year's ceremony, which would be
good. I hope so. That would be great.
Yeah, that's the one thing I love about this, what Renny Leroux has done. As I mentioned to you, I grew up in Philadelphia. I'm a Flyers fan, and that era was just an incredible era. I spoke with Joe Watson a little bit earlier, and just chatting with him, former Flyer, great defenseman, won two cups with the team, and just celebrated the 50th anniversary of the last Stanley Cup back on Monday. So, but this is the one thing I get. And I appreciate Renny inviting me every year to be able to talk to these guys. I mean, these guys who, as a kid, I hate it. But to be able to tell them that and laugh about it and just be able to interview these guys like Dennis Potvin and John Stanley, Bob Nystrom. I can't wait to talk to Billy Smith. I think that'll be an interesting interview because he's getting inducted as well. Because how Billy seemed to be his nickname, obviously, is battling Billy because he didn't like anybody in his crease from the opposition. He was Ron Hextall before Ron Hextall.
He did.
I just love to be able to talk to these guys and pick their brains and talk about what they did and accomplished, and it's to be involved in with these people and these hockey players. It's a thrill for me. And I told Joe Watson this, one of the reasons I got into this business because of the Broad Street Bullies. I wanted to be involved in sports, whether it was being part of a team or covering. And I've been covering hockey, both the American Hockey League and college hockey, for just about 30 years now. So it's to me, this is just I love this job. And
nice.
So I wanted to ask you
about.
I wanted to ask you one other thing. You covered the Mike Sullivan press conference with the new Rangers head coach. What'd you make of the change there with the Rangers?
Good one, good energy, cup winner, forceful personality. I think he'll put them on the right path. They definitely needed a change after what happened this season. He's been there before. It was his assistant coach. John Tortorella was the coach. So some of the guys even played for him. Chris Kreider did. So good change. I think the right type of persona to be behind the bench. Of course, the roster has to adjust to him. I'm sure there'll be adjustments to the roster. So, last year was odd. The Rangers going from President's Trophy to out of the playoffs, a 29-point fall, weird. Just nothing was really working. Strange personnel shifts, and it just seemed like their heart wasn't in it too often. But hopefully this coaching change will bring positive energy back to the Rangers.
And what do the Islanders have to do to rebound?
They just need to get younger. I think the heart and soul, the work ethic, all that's in place. The captain, Anders Lee, brings it every night. I don't think it's a question of effort. I just think they didn't quite have the right mix. You need some more help on the blue line and just a more younger, faster offensive talents to complement Matthew Barzal, who was injured a lot of the season. So that hurt them. Their special team suffered without him. They just didn't have enough horsepower to overcome to get into the playoffs. I mean, the Devils are a younger version of what the Islanders should be, could be. So I think it's a youth factor, and I'm sure that's going to be happening the next year or two or three, an infusion of young talent, some of their high draft picks. I mean, this number one pick's going to be a factor no matter who they choose. And Patrick Waugh, I think, hope he stays. I think unleashed till his second full season, we'll see more creativity perhaps and his personality coming through. So I feel like positive days are also ahead for them. I think the race in that Metropolitan Division should be very close, 25-26 season, for numerous reasons. The Devils aren't going anywhere. Carolina's always there. The Caps are strong. Columbus was really impressive. Flyers, new coach and Rick Tocchet. So a lot going on. It could be a 6-7 team race for four spots.
Yeah, it'll be
in
a lot of
divisions. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, it'll be a lot of fun to watch. The book is called Miracle Gold, Four Stanley Cups, and a Lifetime of Islanders Hockey. Ken Morrow and Alan Creta, appreciate a few minutes. I'll see you in July.
Yes, thank you so much. Happy to come on anytime. Appreciate the time.
All right, that's Alan Creta. I'll be back to wrap up the podcast and have the latest winner in the Daily Gazette's Auto Racing Contest in just a moment. Stay informed with the Daily Gazette's e-edition. Download our app, sign up to receive our newsletters, and enjoy exclusive reader rewards when you join our growing community today. Head over to www.dailygazette.com to check out our membership plans. And remember, when credibility matters, trust the Daily Gazette.
Time out.
All right. Remember, we're a team that plays together. Listen, the winning will take care of itself. We just have to get everyone involved.
In interscholastic sports, we celebrate what makes every one of us unique. And in the pursuit of a common goal, everyone in the huddle, in the bleachers, and in the community comes together. This message presented by NISFA and the New York State Athletic Administrators Association.
Hi, this is four-time Stanley Cup champion and New York State Hockey Hall of Famer John Tinelli. You're listening to the Parting Shots podcast with Daily Gazette sports editor Ken Schott.
Back to wrap up the podcast. The Week 14 winner in the Daily Gazette's auto racing contest was Edward Balms of Schenectady with 45 points. Edward wins a $50 gift card. Congratulations, Edward. The VIP winners was everyone with five measly points. Scott Luzier won a tiebreaker. He's, of course, of Capital Land GMC. He leads the standings right now with 220 points. Jerry Peel of Frankensons is next with 190. Dwayne Leach of All Seasons Equipment has 185. Nick Platel, Grand Premier Tire, with 170. Yours truly is at 165. And Matt Margiotta of S&G Roofing has 80 points. I'll announce the auto racing contest winner's name, and that winner's name will appear in Saturday's Daily Gazette. To play, go to dailygazette.com and click on the auto racing contest banner. Just because COVID-19 mandates are easing, that does not mean you should relax. Be vigilant. If you have not gotten vaccinated or received a booster shot, please do so. Do it for yourself. Do it for your family. Do it for your friends. Also, vaccines do not cause autism, and people want the booster shot. Don't forget to download the Daily Gazette app and sign up for our e-edition so you never miss a headline. Subscribe today at www.dailygazette.com. We have a lot of great specials going on. When credibility matters, trust the Daily Gazette. On the latest edition of the Stan and Shen Show, Stan Hootie talks about covering two concerts at SPAC and covering the various Memorial Day remembrances. And Stan and Shenandoah Briere look ahead to Belmont Week in Saratoga Springs. Subscribe to the Stan and Shen Show on all your podcast listening platforms. Speaking of Saratoga, the Belmont Stakes, of course, coming up next week, and Mike McAdam will join me for his At the Track Max segment to preview what's going to happen up at Saratoga with the Belmont Stakes spectacular and festival and whatever they call, like to call it. But so tune in next week with Mike McAdam and I. That wraps up another edition of the Parting Shots podcast. I want to thank Alan Creta for coming on the show. If you have questions or comments about the podcast, email them to me at shot, that's S-C-H-O-T-T, at dailygazette.com. Follow me on X, Threads, and Blue Sky at Slapshots. The views expressed on the Parting Shots podcast are not necessarily those of the Daily Gazette Company. The Parting Shots podcast is a production of the Daily Gazette Company. I'm Daily Gazette sports editor Ken Schott. Thanks for listening, and I'll catch you next time. From the Parting Shots podcast studio in Schenectady, New York, good day, good hockey.